of our grandsons have been diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactive disorder, or ADHD. Initially, I had assumed, based on the reading I had done on the subject, that crossed wires in the brain cause their impulsivity, difficulty focusing and concentrating, and their need to be in constant motion. But lately, I've been talking with one of my colleagues, Dr. Billy Kidd, that has begun to make me think differently. He's been talking to me about the role that prenatal stress plays in a developing child's brain. So then I calculated when both of our grandsons' parents were divorced, and sure enough, it was within each boy's first year, which means their parents' relationships were crumbling, no doubt, when the boys were in utero. And in addition, the older boy's mother worked full-time and went to school in order to provide for them. So when I asked myself how each boy's prenatal stress affected his development, and more importantly, beyond management by medicine, how each boy could be helped to outgrow his condition. And that's where my first guest comes in today. Dr. Gail Cloud is a chiropractic physician who specializes in treating those whose neurological and psychological development is impacted by their mother's stress in utero. Dr. Cloud also coaches parents in how to work effectively with their children to undo the results of their kids' prenatal stress without feeling eternally guilty for causing it. Welcome to the program, Dr. Cloud. I'm so delighted to be talking with you today.
Thank you very much, Dr. Beth. I am too, to speak with you.
Yes, good. Excellent. So start from the very beginning, as the song says. How did you get started in this work? Because it seems pretty far afield from a typical chiropractor's role of adjusting for back and neck pain.
It is, yes. I always approached chiropractic differently than many do. I never was in our chiropractic terms, I'll call it a straight chiropractor. They adjust the necks and backs. Mm-hmm. I never was just a straight chiropractor, even in my way of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So number one, I was more interested in the whole energetic system, including the energy of the body and the magnetism and Eastern medicine with acupuncture and the emotions that go with different organs and body parts. But I was also interested in the connection of the body-mind.
Okay. All right. So what made you begin to think so differently from your other colleagues? Because I bet you get a lot of raised eyebrows from the typical chiropractor.
Yes, I did more initially than I do now. It's interesting how times change. You know, now it's more the cutting edge kind of work. But when I first graduated, it was really seen as very different.
Yeah.
And I suppose it's because my upbringing was very different.
Tell us about that.
One of the differences was that I was raised by a child psychoanalyst who was trained at the Menninger Foundation back when it was the, you know, the primary training facility for psychiatrists and social workers, et cetera. And my father had a very different idea about things, and I was greatly shaped by him.
Uh-huh. What made his ideas so different that you also adopted them?
Well, you know, Dr. Beth, it's interesting you ask that because, you know, we look at these connections and we talk about the stress on the children.
Uh-huh.
And I think he tells a story about himself, which I think so profoundly affected him. When he went into his work, he decided he was going to study this too, which is that when he was 2 years old, he was profoundly abused by a babysitter. One day it was... he called it a fear day, and the other day it would be a pain day. And this went on probably for about a year. So I think what happened is he grew up and said, you know, I want to listen to these kids, these young kids, before they have voices, and I want to help them.
Wow.
Yeah.
How did the abuse that he experienced even come to light, or did it?
I think what ended up happening, his mother worked, you know, the story, you know, very similar, really kind of story to what you told about your grandchildren.
Uh-huh.
Mom worked, dad wasn't gone a lot, they fought a lot. Dad was gone a lot, the parents fought, and they brought in a babysitter. And I think what happened was a neighbor noticed something and said something to the mom, but it took a while for the neighbor to notice.
So what she noticed, I'm guessing, is that he was behaving strangely, perhaps?
She noticed that, and I believe she actually might have witnessed some of the pain or some of the abuse, and told his mom.
How does that impact a child's developing psyche from a PTSD standpoint?
Right. No, that's a really good question.
Post-traumatic stress disorder, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. It can be in the womb, and it can be the most important times for that development where you really see the effects of the trauma and the overwhelm on the babies is the last 3 months in utero, because that's when the right brain is developing. And the first 4 months after birth is primary importance.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, then it goes to two or three until they can really have words to begin to talk about what happened. Yeah.
You write that you can help heal the nervous system and even the DNA that was damaged in development. How do you do that?
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting. It's not actually the chromosome that can be healed. But what happens when there's trauma, even that young, the coat, the epi, the coating of the DNA is affected and traumatized.
And what does that mean?
So what that means is, so I'll give you an example.
Okay.
When a baby is developing in utero, the baby is really carrying three generations of DNA, their own, their parents, and the grandparents.
Okay.
Sometimes, for example, something will happen to one of their grandparents or their parents, very, very traumatic. It could have been sexual trauma. It could have been, you know, some kind of violence.
Mm-hmm.
It could have been a terrible loss. You know,
right, like the death of a parent.
Exactly, exactly. And when that happens, it's the post-traumatic stress, the hippocampus, which is the part of the brain in the back of the brain, which is designed to organize everything, to organize the thoughts and the words and the memories and categorize it and put it in a place.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It gets overwhelmed, so it can't do that. So that trauma goes to their frontal brain.
Okay.
And so it's always there, and that's why it could be any kind of trigger that could bring the memory out.
And what happens in the frontal brain, Dr. Gale?
So what happens in the frontal brain, that's where it affects their how they see things, their stimuli, how they interpret noise and sound, taste, touch, all their senses, as well as the way they think, their thought processes.
And what is the role of the right brain as opposed to the left brain?
Okay, so in the right brain we know as our creativity. That's what, you know, artists use a lot, writers use a lot. It isn't as organized as the left brain. The left brain we think of as an accountant uses mostly left brain kind of information, counting numbers and putting things together. Right brain is more spatially oriented. It has to do with awareness, sensation, creativity, connection, those kinds of things.
Okay, and how does that become associated? You're giving me a crash course in this. I really appreciate it, Dr.
You're
Gale.
My pleasure.
How is that associated? What's the connection to ADHD then?
So if we're talking about in the womb and early the very, very early times after birth.
Mm-hmm.
That is when that part of the brain's developed. So that child, that baby, becomes totally aware of their surroundings. They hear what's going on. They have a connection to mom, so that everything that's about mom, they totally know. Their sensations, their awarenesses are developing.
Okay.
So what happens is everything around them is acutely available to them.
Hmm.
And they have no words to describe it or to help them, and they have no way yet to cope or deal with all those sensations, connections coming to them. So, for example, in your example, when parents fight, when there's yelling, when there's disharmony, when mom's upset, I mean, it only has to be mom upset because that's how connected that baby is to mom.
Mm-hmm.
Baby's upset.
Yes.
And baby doesn't have any words for it. So in the soul, we all have our soul, in our heart and soul, a child, a baby yearns for both parents, has a strong, deep yearning for
mm-hmm.
both parents.
Mm-hmm.
And when there's yelling, screaming, disrespect, whatever, the child is torn. So they're torn in pieces. They want to be loyal to mom. They want to be loyal to dad. And they want to step in and help mom. They want to step in and help dad. How can they?
Yes, exactly.
And it makes them hyper. They have to be hypersensitive, mm-hmm. hyper-aware, hyper-tuned. They can't stay focused on one or the other. Right? All the kinds of symptoms that we'll describe in ADD, ADHD. And they'll start to notice if they watch TV or they are around children too much or they have to sit still any time they can't, because they can't stay focused. And that started very, very young
mm-hmm.
in that trying to please both of their parents.
Okay. So what impact does it have on a child's developing brain when one parent, and it is usually the father, abdicates his role as father completely and is absent from the child's life?
That is actually a different dynamic than just the ones that create that ADD, that inability to stay focused or sit still. Because let me put it this way. If dad is disrespected by mom, so dad abdicates his role as a parent. Mom then says, oh, your dad, he's such a yucky guy, and he did this and he did that, and now he's out of your life, and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
If mom is doing that, the child will feel torn, and it will have that symptoms of lack of focus and anxiety and all those kinds of things, because they're put in that horrible position, a position
yeah.
a child should never be put into.
Yes, exactly. So that's the psychological dynamic of that. Is there any neurological implication of that that you're aware of?
What I'm aware of, what starts to happen, and it gets, again, like there's a trigger in the genetic coat we talked about,
mm-hmm.
and that when dad leaves could be a trigger in the coat of some kind of trauma that happened before, for example. So let's just say, in grandparents' time, daddy died.
Mm-hmm.
In this generation, daddy leaves. Okay? What gets triggered is that trauma, and there could be all kinds of neurological implications. The child might have an anxiety disorder.
Mm-hmm.
Might.
Or become depressed.
Might become depressed. Most likely will become depressed. Won't be able to carry their weight. Not their physical weight, but their mm-hmm. emotion, psychological weight. So they don't have, they are very moody. They can be very moody. They aren't able to focus. They might have dyslexia-type problems because
yes.
they're put in that kind of position mm-hmm. where they have to decide mom or dad, and it's a kind of decision that nobody should ever make, and it affects them spatially also.
How does that affect them spatially?
And well, actually, dyslexia is a spatial neurological
yes.
issue. So
uh-huh.
what happens is they are not able to make the, they can't make, there's no good choice. In time and space, there's no good choice and no right or best way to do something, and it messes with their orientation neurologically.
And orientation means?
Well, literally, it would be oriented towards their relationship and their what's expected and accepted by the parents.
Uh-huh.
Towards each other. That's okay. The literal orientation. And because they're not able to find a place and their place between their parents parents,
mm-hmm.
you see, then it creates that other type of orientation difficulty.
Okay. All right. You urge mothers to talk to their babies in utero. Why is that?
Oh, because it really helps their connection with their babies, and their babies really understand. There's been studies in which they have, through ultrasound, watched developing babies, and that when their moms, it'll have been in a therapist's office.
Mm-hmm.
So when mom is talking about how they can't wait for the baby to be born, and they can feel the baby inside and what a wonderful feeling it is, and they're excited, the babies can't get close enough to the umbilical cord. They're as close as they can be. They just can't get close enough.
Mm.
And then when the mom says, on the other hand, I'm scared and I don't know if my husband's going to be available, and the baby starts to go as far away as they can into a very isolated space in the womb, as isolated as one can find in the womb. But
wow.
It moves as far away from the cord as possible.
Just wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
It is so powerful, Dr.
Yeah.
Beth.
No kidding. I was unaware of that research.
Mm-hmm.
This is Dr. Beth Erickson. Today I'm talking with Dr. Gail Cloud, Relationships 101. So, in addition to the mothers talking lovingly about the baby, that provides reassurance and strengthens the connection between mother and infant. But neurologically then, what happens? What's going on for the baby?
In that kind of ideal relationship where the mom is able to really talk with the baby and,
mm-hmm.
you know, connect with the baby, and the baby feels the love, you
mm-hmm.
know, and feels
mm-hmm.
safe and feels protected, that sense of safety and protection allows their nervous system to develop
normally.
Yes, and uncompromised, yes.
Okay, all right. Wow, this is fascinating stuff.
Mm-hmm. It really is.
Uh-huh, wow. So you also have shared with me that you work with adult children to help them heal from the impact of their mother's stress. How do you do that?
It's a beautiful process. I use a family systems work called the family constellation work
mm-hmm.
As my background material to work with the adults. And I just worked with, I did a beautiful case I did with a woman this weekend, as a matter of fact, just yesterday, who was a Polish Holocaust survivor, Jewish, and lots of horrible, horrible things that happened. And so her experience as a very young girl and as growing in the womb was a horrible experience for her, and it has no words. It's one of the ways you know it's so young is
yes.
there no words for it.
Uh-huh.
So I would be sitting next to her, looking at her, talking to her, keeping her in her body because she would want to dissociate from her body.
Mm-hmm.
And we would have representatives there, people that would step in to, let's say, represent her mom and, let's say, represent her dad. And I even had someone step in to represent her as the baby in utero.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my.
It was very powerful because then she could see, not just have that experience that's all over herself and gets triggered by all kinds of things, but she can have a visual orientation. And I talk with her as she watches. And I tell her, well, this is what happened when you were in the womb. And I explain what she's seen in ways that calm her.
Yes.
And talk about how unsafe she felt and alone she felt and unconnected to mom. And found words that spoke to her, words that she couldn't find herself. as she watched people, even though they can't know what was really happening, they get a sense of them. It's kind of a powerful experience.
Yes.
And it's called the morphogenic field, and mm-hmm. it's almost like it's just that consciousness people feel around each other. And so she would see it, and I'd talk to her, and then I would help her get closer and closer so she could stand close to her mom herself and finally even go into her mom's arms and find what strength, and even found words. For example, maybe mom had one drop of love she was able to give you, and look what you did with that one drop of love and what you do with it.
Yeah.
So that type of way.
Wow. It sounds also, if I'm going to talk shrink here for a minute, it sounds also like it healed a split for the woman. You know, when people experience traumas that they can't deal with, or they're too little to know how to deal with, they split off a part of themselves so they can keep that part out of their awareness. Otherwise, they would be overwhelmed with it. Mm-hmm. And so it sounds like what you're describing yesterday had the possibility of having healed a split that this woman most likely experienced in the concentration camp when she felt so separated and so unloved from her mother, who herself must have lived in terror.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very possible.
Yeah.
Very possible. I know she told me later that this gave her something that no other work has been able to give her.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
You know, this reminds me of a case, a woman I treated, 25 years ago, and she surmised she had been physically and sexually abused, but when I would retrieve it, I would go to retrieve it, using hypnosis, there was nothing there. Mm-hmm. And finally, one day, I had this experience when she said, "There are no words." And I said, "So that's the deal. You must have been just months old when it began." And she said, "Yes, that's it, that's it." So that's so similar to the prenatal and perinatal experience that we're talking about right now.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. You know, too, along those lines, Dr. Beth, we have seen in this work how on occasion, someone will just have the symptoms and just feel that they had some sexual trauma. And just like you, we couldn't find it.
Mm-hmm.
And we found through this work, it's possible that it happened to their mother or their grandmother, but it lives in them, in their nervous system today through that trauma.
Yes.
As if it was theirs.
Yes. Ugh.
Mm-hmm.
Poor children. When you think of it that way, they're such innocent victims, really, of events that happen either in their parents' or grandparents' lives that they have no knowledge about beyond this sense that something was gravely wrong.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, when I was studying ADHD, now this is probably 15 years ago, the current wisdom at the time was that ADHD was hereditary and that it's passed down to a child through the father, and particularly male children are susceptible to it, are more susceptible than female children. And yet everything you're saying today seems to refute that. How, help us understand that.
Well, I think that part of this may be boys have a different, you know, boys and girls are just really different.
Yes, they
are. And the boys have just, I mean, you watch little boys and little girls play, and little boys are all over the place, right?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And little girls, as a rule, and little girls can sit in one place and color or play with their dolls for long periods of time.
Uh-huh.
So I'm wondering if people got confused by ADD, ADHD and thought more in boys, because they didn't recognize
sure.
as the same in girls.
Yes.
That's what I'm wondering.
Okay. And that were the case, that would be a large measure of socialization that's different for both genders.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. And a girl might have trouble focusing, but maybe because she could sit for a longer period of time, it wasn't recognized.
Yes, exactly. So if a mother is in a highly stressful situation through no fault of her own, like
yes.
job loss or the death of a parent, mm-hmm. What do you suggest to help her insulate her baby as much as possible from the impact of this natural stress?
You know, that's a difficult question. You know, nowadays I can tell you, and it depends upon how much and in what ways that woman is impacted by the stress, by the mm-hmm. death of their parent or by the stress of a job or whatever it may be. So the more they have their own inner strength and the more they've done their own inner healing, they might feel sad and they might feel stressed, but they're able to retain a connection to their child.
Yes. Okay.
But if they don't have that inner strength, then with that added stress or the death, it's very difficult for them to. I mean, I could talk to them. We could talk to them how to do it and different things they could do. But if they don't have it inside, the child's going to know.
Yes, and get very anxious for the parent mm-hmm. as a result. So what I want to underscore in the form of takeaways for my listeners is that stress, of course, is a natural part of life. So the key is how we learn to manage it so we don't damage ourselves and our offspring. And if you really want to insulate your developing child from stress, as well as do stress reduction management yourself, learn self-soothing techniques like a warm bath, meditation, mm-hmm. and I would think rubbing your belly when you're pregnant would be very soothing to a child.
Yeah, rocking in a chair, rubbing your belly, lighting candles, drinking chamomile tea, you know, all of those,
uh-huh.
absolutely, you're absolutely right.
And so during that time then when you're hyper-stressed, if you can talk reassuringly to your baby, that's going to help in much the same way that research indicated that when mothers talked lovingly to their baby, the baby couldn't get close enough, and when she was distracted and fussy herself, the baby got as far away from the umbilical cord as possible. So the best way to nurture the brain, I think, is soothingly and reassuringly and manage your own stress. And then when the baby's born, continue the conversation. Whether the baby can talk back with you or not is irrelevant. Dr.
Absolutely.
Cloud, thank you so very much for being with us today. I absolutely know we've just barely scratched the surface of this important information, and I've certainly appreciate your sharing it with us.
Thank you, Dr. Beth, and thanks for having me on your show.
Of course. Now we come to the segment from the files of Dr. Beth. Many years ago, I was asked by the parents of a young college girl to help them help her. The girl had been able to keep her pregnancy a secret from everyone, including her parents and even her roommate. Her parents found out that she was pregnant after she delivered the baby in the restroom in her dorm and tried to flush him down the toilet in an attempt to continue to hide the pregnancy. Only the baby was just simply too big to be flushed down the toilet. It wouldn't go. Of course, the girl's parents were horrified. I met with her only once before she was arraigned, and she showed little remorse because she was clear she didn't want the baby and didn't see adoption or abortion as options. Her parents subsequently became the custodial parents of this little baby boy because his mother was prosecuted and imprisoned for attempted murder. Imagine the stress this little one endured throughout his mother's pregnancy. For one thing, he got no prenatal care whatsoever. And when she attempted to murder him, that's the unspeakable. This child would now be in his 20s, and I can't imagine how he would ever have a normal life or a normal relationship with his mother when she was released from prison. Imagine the stress level that is woven into his DNA as a result of all of this. Poor, innocent baby. Poor, desperate girl. Stay tuned. In the second half of the show, I'll be talking with Janet Pfeiffer about holiday tips for making the season bright for yourself and others at the same time. Don't go away. I'll be right back. When I was a child, although we didn't have a lot ourselves, Mama and Daddy were always generous with what we had. It's Dr. Beth Erickson, host of Relationships 101, and I'm really glad you joined us. Every Saturday afternoon, I would go with Daddy to deliver a dressed chicken, a dozen eggs, and a pound of butter to our pastor's home. And Mama would cook enough at the holidays to bring hot food to our widowed country doctor and the poorest family in town that lived in a tiny shack down by the railroad tracks. Clearly, our parents were role models of generosity. Last night, I was late getting home from the office because I had stopped to get a few holiday gifts. Because it's dark in Minnesota by 4:30 in the winter, it was pitch dark and cold. The actual high temperature of the day had been 14 degrees, and that, of course, was when the sun was out. So by 6 o'clock, it was really cold. Thank goodness there was little wind. As I drove away from my last store, I came upon a young man and a dog huddled in the island in the middle of the road. His sign said, "Hungry and cold. Can you help?" As the light turned green, I handed him a couple of bucks and went on my way. And then I began thinking about the big pot of 15 bean with ham soup that Paul had simmered on our stove all afternoon. And I decided to rush home to gather up two tubs of soup, crackers, and other food from our pantries, along with fresh fruit. And I also had another bag that contained a hooded sweatshirt and a lap blanket that I don't use anymore, plus a plastic bag of dog food. I quickly headed back to that intersection, hoping he hadn't given up and gone home by the time I got there. He hadn't. So I brought him the bags, for which he expressed much gratitude. As I drove away, the young man was on all fours in the snowbank, tenderly feeding his best friend first. My guest today is Janet Pfeiffer. She also knows the tidy little secret of altruism. You get back way more than you give. Janet is an author and power seminar leader, and she has some great tips to share with us for ways to celebrate the holidays if you are alone. Welcome to the program, Janet.
Oh, Dr. Beth, it's so nice to be here. And I have to tell you, I think we were raised by the same parents.
And aren't we blessed by that?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, you're telling the story and I'm getting tears in my eyes.
Yeah.
And thinking, oh, you can't cry now. You're going on air. But what a beautiful story. Oh, I hope that your listeners take that to heart.
I hope they do, too.
And do something similar. I mean, it was just so touching. And I'm a dog lover, so...
Mm-hmm.
I can just appreciate this young man taking care of his dog first.
Yeah, indeed. So when you say we must have been raised by the same parents, what messages did your parents give you? Tell us about that.
One of generosity, always.
Uh-huh.
My grandparents were immigrants from Italy on my mom's side.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandfather was fortunate enough to start his own business, and he did quite well financially, but he was my grandparents always lived like paupers. If you ever met them, you would swear they didn't have a nickel to their name, but they were always giving away everything they had. My grandmother would cook for the whole neighborhood. And so my mother was raised that way, and so were my sisters and I. It was always about, no matter how little we had, and we didn't have much, it was always about sharing and reaching out to others who had less than we did, because we really truly felt blessed that what little we had, we were grateful for.
Yes, exactly. And that's a powerful message to give children in this day and age that seems like more is not enough.
Right. And I think we're living in an age, sadly, where we're a very me-oriented society.
Yeah.
It's all about me. What do I want? What do I, you know, what can I get? What can I buy? And it's all about the self. And we need to get out of that and concern ourselves more with how can I give to others? Because whatever you give away, you get back tenfold.
Exactly. In fact, my husband said to me when I got back home from my Meals on Wheels mission, he said, "I bet you feel pretty good about yourself, don't you?" And I said, "In fact, yes, I do." He said, "That's good." So if more people would catch on to the idea that when you give, you get so much more back, then I think the world would be a better place.
Oh, I think so, too.
Yeah. However, I want for us to make a distinction between giving from your heart to those who are more needy and giving masochistically. Too many people, I think women especially, get very confused. Well, if I give to my husband or boyfriend, then he'll love me. And that's just plain masochism.
Yes, and I'm really glad that you brought that up, Dr. Beth, because that was something that I learned many years ago. I was a single mom. My first husband left me after 13 years of marriage, so I raised four children on my own, and I was what my therapist called the world's greatest caretaker. She said, "You know what people need before they even know it, and you've already got that need taken care of."
Yeah.
You know, and she said, but you don't take care of yourself. And
yeah.
Part of my need to always give was to get back that sense of recognition that if I, the more I gave, the more people would like me. I mean, it did come truly from a spirit of a generous heart, but there was also that added component of, well, if I give, people are going to think I'm really nice and they'll like me. And I really had to learn the distinction to just truly give from the heart, regardless of what people thought about me, and know that it's okay sometimes to say no, that we have
yes.
to first give to ourselves and nurture ourselves so that we will have something to share with others. Because if you don't take care of yourself first, you literally deplete yourself, and then you're empty. You have nothing that you can offer to anybody else.
Exactly. So, Janet, have you ever been alone on the holidays?
Oh, more times than I could count.
Really?
Yes. I went from the, you know, the traditional big Italian family where everybody celebrated together to, you know, being divorced and losing that whole side of my family. And then, you know, when my children would go with their father and celebrate with them, I was pretty much alone. And so there were many, many years that I did not celebrate the holidays in the traditional way. And it was not easy, but you become very creative, and you find alternative ways of getting through the holidays that can actually be incredibly rewarding and not depressing, as some people would think.
Right. So give us some of those strategies.
Well, one of the first things, like we were just talking about, was really to focus on what can I do for others.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're so accustomed, you know, during Christmas to be really overindulging our children and family members and friends with all kinds of nonsense things that they really don't need.
Right.
And we kind of lose sight of what is the real meaning of Christmas. Well, I found that when I was completely alone and not celebrating the traditional way, that it really gave me time to think about what is the message of the season. And the whole message of the season, whether you believe in that this is the birth of Christ or not, there is a message there that is about the fact that we are all one, that we need to be there for one another, that kindness and love and forgiveness and generosity is really what that season is all about.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the first Christmases that really jumps out in my mind was one where I had decided that instead of buying all of these gifts for my kids that they didn't need, certainly I would buy some, I decided to find a local family that was struggling financially and purchase gifts for them instead. And I did that with the help of the priest at my parish. He didn't reveal the name of the family, but gave me the ages and sex of the children and what it is they wanted for Christmas. And I went out and I bought gifts for all of them, and then he was able to deliver them. And so I felt like this little secret Santa, but it was just uh-huh. incredibly rewarding to know that, you know, a small act on my part could make a huge difference in the life of somebody else.
Yeah. And didn't you at one point meet a family that you helped and they gave you a tremendous gift?
Yes. Actually, that was the second year that I did this, because I did this Secret Santa a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
But this one particular year, the family was comfortable with me knowing who they were. So I contacted the mother directly, and she gave me a list of everything that the children wanted, but very sparse. She didn't want to overburden me. So I went and I purchased gifts, and I brought them over to her house. I was appalled when I got to her house. I could not believe that this house had not been condemned. It was so bad. And so I'm unloading my car, and I realized that I was short one gift for one of the children. So I said to her, you know what, I have to go to the store and get another gift. I'll be back. And when I had come back, she had made for me an elf. He's about 12 inches tall, all out of felt. He has big googly eyes, and he's got a little bell on his cap. And here she hands me this gift that she had handcrafted. Now, I just put him up on my mantle on Saturday. I've had him now for almost 30 years. He is truly one of the most cherished gifts anybody has ever given me. Because here this woman who couldn't even feed her children took the time to make me a gift when that's what I was there to do for her. It just meant the world to me. I can't even tell you how touched I was by her generosity.
It sounds like the biblical story of the widow's mite,
yes.
MITE, where mm-hmm. the widow gave of what she had, which was just a tiny few coins. But in the parable Jesus told, he talked about giving from the heart and giving of what you have, whether it's a fantastic sum or not.
Yeah.
And I wonder if sometimes people talk themselves out of giving because they don't have much to give, or they think, well, what could I offer that would be, you know, useful and meaningful to someone else? And sometimes I bet that's even an excuse on people's part. But you're missing the gift you get back when you do that.
And I think, too, is that people underestimate, you know, small acts of generosity. All right, it's not everybody in the world can afford to donate, you know, $10,000 or give away a new car.
Right.
But people can afford, you know, $1 or $5 or $10 here, and that all adds up. And you never know, to somebody who's really struggling, a dollar means a lot.
Yeah.
To you and I, it may be, you know, it just may be pocket change that falls out on the floor of our car. But to somebody else, it could mean the difference between paying their electric bill or eating that night and or not.
Yes.
So, But I think you're right. I think sometimes people will use that as an excuse. Well, you know, I can't write out a check for $100, so I'm just not going to send in anything at all.
Mm-hmm.
Well, whatever you can, no matter how small it is, it all adds up.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. It seems to me that some people, at least, are defeated by the holidays. Have you observed anything like that, too?
Oh, yeah. You know, Dr. Beth, I spent a lot of years working with singles. I used to run a singles organization here in northern New Jersey. So I spent a lot of years working with adults who were no longer together as a couple. And there was a tremendous amount of depression and sadness and even some, you know, bitterness and a touch of the bah humbugs, mm-hmm. that people felt that if they couldn't celebrate the holidays the traditional way, that there was no sense in celebrating them at all. And I really worked hard trying to help people to find alternative ways of celebrating. You know, we're so brainwashed by commercialism and
yes.
by society to think that this is the most wonderful time of the year, and yet statistics show that it's the most depressing time of the year and
mm-hmm.
the most stressful. My God. So I think we have to get away from that and simplify the whole holiday season. Don't try to pack too much in at once, but really get back to the basics of what really makes this season so special and unique, and how can you truly celebrate it in a way that is different from the traditional way, but has at least as much meaning, if not more.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. This is where the concept of chosen family comes in.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
if your family are across the country or are scattered from each other, estranged from each other for one reason or another, that doesn't mean you have to be family-less. You can adopt a chosen family by inviting them to your house to celebrate. Could you share with us that dinner invitation you made to your friends who were alone?
Yes, and I've actually done this many, many times. But one year, and I don't remember what year it was, but I remember just, you know, the holidays were coming and I was feeling a little down. And then I just thought about all of these single friends that I have who don't have family in the area or who are not speaking to their families. So what I did was I sent out an invitation to all of them to come to my house for dinner. And I said, you know what, I don't know how many people are actually going to show up, so we're going to make it potluck. Everybody who comes has to bring something. And, of course, I prepared a lot of foods, which was so much fun. I mean, I love that cooking and baking and the homemade breads and cookies and all that kind of stuff. So I was having fun preparing all of this. And I had said to my friends, like, I invited all the people that I knew. I said, but if you know people as well, I trust your judgment. You're not going to bring a burglar into my house. I said, extend the invitation to everyone that you know. And we had a wonderful group of people here. And some of those people, years and years and years later, are still some of my closest friends.
I was going to say,
talk about that. Yeah.
Uh-huh. That was all, it was a double duty strategy. It also expanded your own social network.
Yeah, and we've done that for many holidays. Valentine's Day is a very tough day for single people.
Yes,
and so I would always have a huge, you know, Valentine's Day dance at my house, and, you know, we'd push all the furniture back and decorate, and all of us, all those who weren't with someone would come, and we'd all have a ball.
Mm-hmm.
So you're right about reaching out. There's extended family. We're not just connected through blood, but we're connected really through our heart. You know, this is one big family that lives on this planet,
uh-huh.
and we have to stop dividing ourselves by, you know, what state we live in or what country we live in or our national background or our color of our skin. We're all one family, and if we can remember that and reach out and embrace everyone during these times, we can see just how big our family really is and how many wonderful people are out there that we may not have ever met before.
Yes, exactly, which is a wonderful cure for the holiday blues.
Oh, it certainly is.
My guest is Janet Pfeiffer. I'm Dr. Beth Erickson. The show is Relationships 101. Another reason that some people have a difficult time on the holidays is if they have suffered a loss during the year since the last set of holidays, whether it's a loss from divorce or the death of a child or a parent, the losses that are involved in getting divorced, even if the divorce was your idea. And so I just want to hold up for people that if you have a difficult time these holidays, there's nothing wrong with you. In fact, if you lean into your feelings, you'll come out the other side much more quickly and much better. And yet, people's first instinct often when it comes to a loss is, well, I just don't want to feel that. I'm going to see if I can short-circuit it so I don't feel it. And that only protracts, it only lengthens the process of grieving. So be careful of doing that to yourself. And again, if you have experienced a loss in this previous year, then of all times, you may want to surround yourself with people who are non-judgmental, even if it's just a handful. I mean, it doesn't have to be a big bash like it sounds like you've described, Janet. And so just even a few. I used to, when I lived in Chicago and my family are all here in Minnesota, I used to have Thanksgiving for orphans.
Oh, I love that. That's beautiful.
Yeah. And, you know, so again, it's the idea that get back so much more than you give.
You do. You do. And I think you mentioned something a few minutes ago about, you know, going through divorce or losing a loved one in death. You know, there's no rule that says we have to hold on to old traditions. We can create a whole new set, which is what I did when my marriage ended. I remember that first Christmas was very, very difficult to get through. And, you know, I was used to having my husband there early in the morning. We're all opening gifts and everything. And he wasn't there that year. So I had said to my children, why don't we invite all of your friends over for a brunch? We'll make that our new tradition, that Christmas morning, everybody gets up, we open our gifts, and then we have a big brunch with homemade pancakes and muffins and sausage and you name it. And then after that, then we would go out, you know, to whoever was hosting Christmas dinner that year. And so that became one of our new traditions. And so just create a new way of celebrating it. Letting go of the old traditions can be painful, but you replace them with something new that can be equally as rewarding.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad passed away last year. Ooh. And so what we do now for the holidays is that we remember him in a special way. We'll set aside maybe time on, you know, at Christmas dinner to just talk about the fond memories that we have of him, or we'll honor him in some other way. He was, you know, he was a veteran, so we may drop in at a veteran's home and bring some, you know, Christmas cheer to the veterans. Any way at all to honor a lost loved one is a way of keeping them alive and really just, I don't know, kind of soothing some of the hurt at the holidays.
Yes, and some of the emptiness, filling the
emptiness. Oh, yeah. Yep.
Exactly.
Yeah. And my dad had such a great sense of humor. We would sit around and we'd tell jokes about him because that's the kind of guy he was. He loved it if you teased him and made fun of him, you know, in a loving way.
Yes.
And so that kind of, you know, that eases a lot of the pain as well for us.
Mm-hmm. So it's what you're suggesting is a way to keep a lost loved one with you in your heart, even though you know you have had to let them go because they, in fact, are dead. And that can be very comforting.
Yeah, it's worked for me, and it's really, I can see how my family has benefited from it as well. So, you know, you just have to do what you feel comfortable with. And you know what? Sure. If this is the first holiday without a loved one and you really just don't have the strength to celebrate, then skip it. There's no law that says you have to get, you know, in the holiday spirit. If you really feel like you need to just lay low and let the holidays kind of drift by without really acknowledging them, then do that. If that's what you feel you need to do, don't feel the pressure that you have to be cheerful and celebrate just because, you know, a lot of the other world is. You don't have to. You be true to yourself and honor your feelings, like you were saying before. Acknowledge what you're feeling and go with it. Don't suppress them or deny them.
Mm-hmm. Some other strategies for curing the holiday blues are to remember that part of what depresses people around this time of year is the childhood fantasy, and maybe it's even a memory, too, of the perfect Christmas. And if people look at their life now, if they've just gotten divorced or they've been laid off or whatever the situation, it's far from perfect. So that comparison seems to be part of what digs the hole of depression and loneliness. So don't go there. don't go there. And do a reality check as an adult. It isn't going to be a child's Christmas because you are an adult now. But what you can also do is help other children have Merry Christmases. I donate every year to Toys for Tots. And that's just part of my holiday routine. And I'm a master shopper, so it's not that I
know I liked you.
So I buy things on clearance, and I go to discounts so that it doesn't break the bank, and I can get a lot of gifts for kids who just aren't going to have gifts this year without the help of something like that. Or Santa Anonymous, as you referred to a while ago, Janet.
Yes, yes.
Lots of houses of worship also have what's called giving trees.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, where there is a stocking or some kind of gift tag for what a person or a family needs. And mm-hmm. so you can pick off that giving tree. Like one year I remember of the family who requested a $25 gift card from a food store. Well, $25 isn't going to break the bank, so I bought that.
Yeah.
And so there are just lots of ways to celebrate the holidays in a meaningful way without being dependent on enjoying it because of the life you had before.
Right. And I want to point something out too, Dr. Beth, is that celebrating the holidays and being generous doesn't necessarily mean that it has to cost money.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people are thinking, well, geez, I can barely pay my mortgage. I can't afford to go out and buy some family, $25 worth of groceries. But you know what? What you can do is you can write letters to our servicemen and women who are overseas.
Mm-hmm.
You can,
mm-hmm.
you know, you can send Christmas cards to a veteran's home. You can do those kinds of things. You can visit an elderly neighbor who maybe doesn't have family and just drop in and have a cup of tea with them.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many ways mm-hmm. that we can honor one another at the holidays that don't cost a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, too, one year, well, it was one year that I participated, but every year at Christmas, my church would ask for volunteers to come in to help prepare the church for the Christmas season. And so uh-huh. we would clean all the pews and vacuum and wash walls and all kinds of stuff. And the priests were great because they'd put on this great holiday music and they'd get maybe 15 or 20 volunteers and we'd be in there and we'd be scrubbing that church down and polishing things and singing. And I'm telling you, did I feel in the holiday spirit?
I bet you did.
I was ecstatic. So doing that, if that doesn't cost anything, if you don't have money to do something like that, or even get involved in, like I look through the newspaper all the time and there's all kinds of free holiday events that are going on at churches and malls all over the area. So
mm-hmm.
find
mm-hmm.
those things. Go to a church and attend a free Christmas concert, you know?
Right, exactly.
And that really helps you too. Yeah, and that I think for me, that really helps me to feel the spirit of Christmas when I'm in church and I'm listening to the music or going through a prayer service. It's just so meaningful for me, and it doesn't matter then. You know, the gifts and the presents, they become meaningless when I have that kind of an experience. To me, that's what the holidays are really all about.
Yes. Janet, it's been lovely talking with you.
Dr. Beth, it has truly been my pleasure. I've had so much fun, and I hope that your listeners find some hope in today's program, that this holiday season, no matter what their circumstances are in life, it can be a beautiful and meaningful experience for them.
Yes, exactly. Well, don't be a stranger.
Oh, I won't. Okay. We'll stay connected, and I would love to come back on your show anytime.
Yes, I want to have you back in a few months to talk about your book on anger.
Oh, I would love to. The Secret Side of Anger. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
Whenever you're ready.
Okay, I shall let you know.
Okay, thanks, Dr. Beth.
Uh-huh. Coming up next week, I will be talking with William Cope Moyers, who's the Vice President of Foundation Relations at Hazelden, a recovery center here in the Twin Cities. And the focus of our conversation will be how he finally managed to kick his vicious cocaine addiction. I'll also be talking with Delia Moon on the after effects of the deaths of both of her parents by the time she was 2 years old. Please come back next week, and please have a wonderful, blessed holiday season, whether it's Hanukkah or Christmas or whatever it is that you're celebrating this year. And come back and see us. This is Dr. Beth Erickson, host of Relationships 101. I'll look forward to seeing you next week. Bye.